And perhaps where the misunderstanding is that Judaism is about having a high bar. It's about having a high standard and being committed to that standard. So it's about being solid and having a commitment. But it's very flexible and it's very warm and it's very loving. And therefore, if you come across a group of people, a community, or an individual person or family or community that is in fact rigid about their Judaism, that's not actually true Torah Judaism. That's not what it is. So for us to understand practically what it means to be a Torah observant Jew, which is from the perspective we're coming at tonight, here's how we understand it. When there's a gap between me and Torah, there are two ways to see it. Number one, I will adapt the Torah to me. Number two, I will adapt myself to Torah. So what we believe, our philosophy, is we believe that the Torah is God-given. And therefore, the Torah is completely binding. And we adapt ourselves to the Torah. And the Torah, along with the mitzvot, were a means, a method that Hashem gave us, that God gave us in order to create a deep and meaningful relationship with Him. So that's in a nutshell who we are and what our philosophy is. Okay, and now, are we ready to begin? Drum roll. And thank you, Avivit. She gave us a good drum roll over there. All right, so the very first thing that I'm going to be asking some questions, and I want you to know that all the questions that we're asking, we compiled a lot of questions that came in, consolidated them according to category, but these are all your questions, okay? So listen carefully, and I also want you to know that right now, we're not going to open up to questions over here because otherwise we're not going to be able to stick to our itinerary and also time-wise, but you are more than welcome to write down your questions, send them in to us, and we will actually consider having a part two to this to answer the next questions that come from this. All right? So we are going to start with what Judaism believes regarding dating and marriage. How does it work? Okay, and I'm going to open up the floor right now first to Gevura. Okay, who is the hostess with the mostest right down there? Oh, she's down on my screen. I don't think her screens are all the same.
I'm slightly flustered because I'm getting text, Facebook, WhatsApps like 12 per second because we tried to upgrade to 1,000 people, but we're not able to, even though it registered on my credit card. So I apologize that we had the cap it at 300, but we are on Facebook Live now. So if any of your friends want to get on, they can. Sorry, Afa, you didn't see that message, but I asked everyone else if that's okay with them.
I'm fine with it. Don't worry. I put on some lipstick.
My husband is okay. It's not as bright as usual. And my husband is quickly trying to accept all of my Facebook requests as furiously as possible. So let me first start by introducing myself for those of you that I don't know. And each of the speakers before we speak, we're just going to share a little bit about our background so that you can best understand us and maybe the diverse perspectives that we're coming from. So I grew up in suburban Atlanta. And I had very little exposure to, zero exposure to Orthodox Judaism. In fact, my father once, living in Atlanta, like I didn't know that there were such things as Orthodox Jews. So much so that when the Chabad opened up a few miles from my house, the rabbi we would sometimes drive past the rabbi on Saturdays and he was wearing, his hat and his garfel, you know, like his full religious regalia. And we thought that he was a Jews for Jesus that like popped up trying to convert us because there are a lot of J for J's in Georgia, where I'm from. And in fact, once when my very first exposure to Hasidim and to Orthodoxy was when my father pulled me into a room for a PBS special called A Life Apart. About Hasidim that came out in the 90s. And my dad pulled me and my sister into the room and showed it took place in, I mean, it was a true documentary about life in Brooklyn. And my dad said, oh, these are Jewish people. And we started laughing because they looked much more like Amish to us. And one of my next experience, my first experience seeing very religious looking Jews was when I was a student at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And my bus would drive through, the bus in Jerusalem would drive through the religious neighborhoods, and I looked at them like they were aliens, you know, like very incomprehensible. They looked different. They sounded different. Everything about them looked so different. And I would try to imagine what their lives were like. Many years later, I ended up by accident sort of getting an apartment in the top of a neighborhood called Har Nof in Jerusalem. And I did, Yaffa, your old stomping ground. And yep. I didn't know the reason that these five buildings at the very top of Har Nof were like $100 a month cheaper than the rest. And the answer was that it was something called Shchun Ger. In all, everyone except for me in my building was Ger Chassid, a type of, a group of Chassidim, similar to Satmar, but different because they're all a little bit different and we're all a little bit different. And I got to know the people in my building, the ones that spoke English, which was only two. And it was a very interesting cultural experience for me. And, I ended up myself becoming an Orthodox Jew. It's funny. My whole life, my whole religious Jewish life, I tried to run identifying with the term Orthodox because it has, you know, as Yaffa said, so many connotations. But for today's purpose, I will say that I will proudly say that we are hopefully open-minded, loving Orthodox Jews. And I have five children. My husband's a rabbi. We're the co-directors of AISH. Many of you have probably heard of AISH Torah International, and we run the Philadelphia branch. And I've spent many years comparing, talking about, studying the differences between modern American culture, which is also not a monolith, and Jewish Orthodox culture. I would say when it comes to dating and marriage, I had a very strong interest in learning what the Torah had to say once I found myself living a Jewish religious lifestyle, because my, you know, my sex education as a kid started when I was 9 years old and my parents took me to see Dirty Dancing. And that, you know, and then I used to stay up after 90210 to watch The Good Stuff, which was Melrose Place. That started at 9 p.m., so it wasn't considered primetime television, so it could be a little bit more risque. And I realized once I was myself considering dating and getting married in the Orthodox way that I had to really educate myself about the system, because a chief component of Judaism, of course, is free will, that we're doing everything on our own volition. That's a huge, probably the foundation of Jewish philosophy, that everything we do is a choice. We have micro choices every single second. And I wanted to be really educated about Jewish dating and marriage because it was very different than the world of Dirty Dancing that I came from. I was a high school varsity cheerleader in Georgia, which you could imagine what that was like, and then a sorority girl at Emory University in the South. And I very quickly found myself living in Har Nof in a very different culture lifestyle. And so I just want to very quickly share with you the general overview, what I learned, a tiny bit about my personal experience for those of you that don't know me. And then we'll keep moving through the questions. Okay. So in Judaism, we look at marriage as the coming together of two halves of one soul, and the purpose of a soul in this world is to experience eternal pleasure, pleasure in this world, but primarily pleasure in the world to come, which will be built exclusively on our decisions in this world. We are going to lie forever in whatever bed we make in this world, and our vehicle of experiencing eternal pleasure will be through our soul. This world, we have bodies, which is our hair, our body, our eyes, and we're connected to our soul, which is that essence of us that was created by God. All of us is created by God. All parts of us are created by God. But our soul is that part that yearns, the part that wants to connect, and that part of us that will be experiencing pleasure for eternity. So the purpose of our soul's mate, because we believe in Judaism that we have a soulmate, and the purpose of our soulmate is to help us achieve our purpose in this world, which will help lead to our eternal purpose. So, you know, when, unfortunately, as my teacher Lori Plotnick always says, we're two halves of one soul, but when God was dividing us, he didn't go like this. It was like this, which is why sometimes it doesn't feel like the people who are married to are soulmates, but in actuality, they're there to help us. They are there to traverse the journey of our soul with us for eternity. And as I said, our eternity is built largely from this world, from our behavior and our choices in this world. So we are looking for our soulmate, and as we look for our soulmate, enters the dating process and marriage, which is the union of the two souls coming together. So many of you probably thought, or the show portrayed, or this concept of arranged marriages, which is not actually the Jewish way. According to Jewish law, both parties have to consent and they have to meet before and make sure that it's a good match. So what is a good match and how does the dating process work? Well, as Yaffa said, all of Orthodoxy is not one monolith. There's not just one way and every person is an individual. But the general process is that it's a very, very researched blind date, meaning a person, before they get married, the prerequisite of getting married has to be that a person gets to know themselves, their soul and their body and their minds and everything that makes them up, their emotions, their spiritual makeup, and they have to figure out what it is they want in this world. What do they want their lives to look like? And which will help them understand who will be the match for their soul's mission in this world. So a person has to think about who they want to marry, what type of personality, what type of profession, you know, all the different things that are important in building a life with another person, building a life of love and building love with that person. So before a couple goes out, often their parents will do, them and their parents and their team, which could be their rabbi, their rebbetzin, their mentor. A rebbetzin, for those of you that don't know, is the Orthodox term for a rabbi's wife. And they will start asking, probing existential questions of what it is that a person is looking for. And then as people suggest an idea, just in a similar way to people suggesting a blind date between two friends, either a neighbor will think of an idea or a professional shadchan, which is someone who meets with individuals and tries to hear what they're looking for, and will then figure out, try to create a list of people who may be compatible. So what happens is a person has to first figure out, to define who they are, what they're looking for, who they think will help them in their world. And often, not always, because there's no absolutes, often their parents will help them in that process of sort of understanding what it is that they think would be good for the person, again, the person who's dating. And what will happen is they'll try to think of people who will work for them, and then you do a ton of research. Often, people will make something called a resume, which is sort of a list of qualities that they possess and sort of lifestyle choices that they're interested in. And they'll try to think about what they want to portray about themselves, what they're looking for. And the family will then research the person. Often on a shidduch, it's called a shidduch resume. Often on the resume will be references, which is people, a family friend, a rabbi, someone who knows them well. But I always, always, always advise people, and when I'm helping people, it's good to call the references if you want to hear that this person is the greatest human alive, because often the references want to sell the person as a good person, the way a best friend, when they're trying to convince someone to go out. But I always say you have to call beyond the references. Right? The questions I like to ask are, have you seen the person get angry? Have you seen the person, spending money? How do they spend money? And really try to get a sense of who the person is before you agree to go out. one aspect of our dating that is very different than the Melrose Place dating is that we observe the laws of Shomer Nagia, which literally means guarding our touch. So in Judaism, men and women will have no physical contact whatsoever until they're married. And then once a person is married, their spouse is the only person of the opposite gender that they will have any contact with at all. So there's no kissing on the dates. There's no hugging, and there's certainly no sexual encounters. People often ask me, you know, the sort of, when they're brave enough, the elephant question in the room, which is, how do you know if you're compatible? And I think that when we talk about intimacy, we'll talk a little bit more about what defines compatibility. So we're not going to discuss that now, but that's not what you're looking for on the date. You're looking for an emotional connection. You're looking for a spiritual connection, and you're asking yourself after every date, could I see myself building a life of love with this person? And,
Gabura, have you watched the new series on Netflix called Love is Blind?
I have not.
Okay, so first of all, there is an older series that's called Married at First Sight. So I've seen Married at First Sight, and now they have a new series that's called Love is Blind, and it's fascinating. Married at First Sight, just so everybody understands, it's like a shidduch system where they have four professionals. They have a psychologist, a sociologist, a sexologist, and a religious leader of some sort, pairing together different applications that they get from people from around the entire United States, and they make four shidduchim. And those people have 10 days to prepare for their weddings. They don't know each other's names. They don't know what they look like, and they meet at the altar for the first time. So it's fascinating. And then you see the series goes on to see how their relationship develops. And if you stay married, if they don't remain together, they need a legal divorce. It's a legal wedding. So that's one. And then they have Love is Blind, which is another series. It's brand new. You should watch it. It's just interesting to see. The goal of Love is Blind is to see if love actually is blind. They have men and women together in a huge mansion. They don't get to see each other. They communicate through the walls. They have a system, obviously, you know, a speaker system. And they get to know each other. They fall in love without seeing each other, just from the questions they ask. They have to get engaged if it works out. They get engaged, and then they come out and meet each other. And then you watch them have 6 weeks to prepare for their wedding. It's a similar concept. But it's fascinating because these ideas, you see the relationships that do work. You see how they can actually have a relationship. They can fall in love just through getting to know each other emotionally. But I'll tell you the truth, that is way more radical and extreme than us, because according to Jewish law, we're not allowed to get married to somebody if we haven't seen them. We have to make sure that there is a physical attraction, there's a physical chemistry, because a shidduch is great, but you know what? Sometimes the shidduch hits the fan, you know? So we gotta make sure that there is an actual physical chemical connection. So I just thought it's fascinating. If you want to watch those shows, you can see how possible it is to actually fall in love with someone without touching them, without being together physically, just by getting to know them emotionally. It's amazing. So have that in mind.
Definitely the idea that you're trying to build an emotional connection. And as we get to intimacy, we'll see how the intimacy develops. But just to quickly answer, I would say that most people in circles that I'm involved in date anywhere from six dates to over a 2-week period to 6 months to a year. So my husband and I actually got engaged on our ninth date after 3.5 weeks, which I know feels and sounds very, very radical, but we felt very confident that we could build a love that lasted. We felt that we understood each other. And we felt that strong chemistry, strong physical attraction. And, of course, to answer anyone's questions, it is very hard not to touch, but that's good because that means that you're desiring the person. And I would say in a lot of secular dating that I hear from other people and that I experienced myself, I would say the goal was very, very different. The goal was to have fun. The goal was to have a sexual experience on the date or in the dating process. Whereas from a Jewish perspective, we date for marriage. We date, and then we don't, people have the choice. It has to be mutual. People have the right to say no. And there's a whole, I don't know if anyone on the call is, but we have a whole practice of dating coaches, people that can help us after each date, ask the right questions, and really understand what it is that we're looking for in the other person. And I highly, highly, highly recommend everyone actually to have a dating coach, because sometimes our emotions get involved. So, you know, we come to every single relationship with our parents' marriage, with our own fears, things that we have observed that we want, that we don't want. And sometimes it really helps to have a third party help sift us through it. And then the marriage, of course, is the coming together of those two souls to build a life together and to help each other achieve their purpose in this world and the next. And as we get to intimacy, we'll see that intimacy is a strong part of the marriage, obviously. So that's like, these subjects we could each talk about for 2 hours, but so that we can keep moving, I'm just going to stop there.
Okay, perfect. Now, before we go on, Sarah Esther, is there anything that you want to add in on this topic? This is Sarah Esther. I'm going to introduce you to her. Let me unmute you. That can be helpful. Let's see. Gavura, are you able to unmute her? Because I can for some reason.
Yeah. Diana, you should be good.
No, she's still muted for some reason. Sarah Esther.
Okay, I'm muted.
We have
you. Excellent. Okay, great. So nice to virtually meet you all. I just want to respond to the question, then I'll do a quick intro. But I loved, Gvura, what you said, and I think one of the key things to keep in mind is that the goal of the shidduch system, one of the goals, is that when a man and woman are meeting, there's so much intensity, and there is ideally so much attraction, and so many other emotions that come into play, that in an ideal situation, we want to know that intellectually, this is somebody that on paper is perfect for what we're looking for. The goal of meeting is to see if emotionally and with physicality and sexual attraction, if all of that is there. But we all know people who fall real hard for the wrong people because the chemistry and attraction is so intense. And that's why we even talk about falling in love and how that, you know, taps into the same areas of the brain that, you know, cocaine does, that we want to avoid making decisions that are simply coming from passion and coming from sexual attraction and coming from physical desire, and know that we have already done the research, looked into this person, ensured that this is somebody that is really what we're looking for. So, you know, I think that's an important understanding. So like what you said, very well researched blind date, that when you then meet, if you kind of the emotions let loose, you're on safe ground. This is somebody that is safe to be falling for. By way of bio, so Gvura and I actually completely crossed paths and missed each other, but I used to live in the area where she now is in Marion Station in Pennsylvania. And now my husband and I, we have been married almost 23 years this June. So going on 23 years. We have 4 kids ranging in age from 15 to 21. And we now live in a very, very rural area of Vermont. I am the Hasidic one in this group. We are Chabad Hasidim. So that is another word that I hate to use, sect, but a different community of Hasidim than the show focused on with Satmar. And I also, I'm a dating and life coach and a relationships coach. I likewise, like you, Yaffa and Gabora and all of you, actually, we all travel around, we speak and we educate. And that's kind of the brief bio. And I do a lot on women's issues. I actually was the creator of the site, thejewishwoman.org, which is the women's site of Chabad.org. So that is my input on the
Wow, date. Very nice. Okay, perfect. So I think now we basically have a little bit of an understanding of how Jewish dating works. We date for marriage. That's our goal. We don't date, you know, just to have fun. And just to add into what you said, that's why when we go on dates, where do we go? We generally go to places where we can sit and talk. We go to, okay, well, I'll say we go to hotels, but I need to clarify. We go to hotel lobbies to sit and talk, okay? Yes. Generally, on a first date. So we go to hotel lobby. We sit and talk. We go to places. We go out to eat. We don't go to the movies generally. We don't go to loud places where we're just going to have fun. We have fun also a little bit later, but the first few dates are really just to see, is this person going to be compatible with me? Do we have similar goals, similar philosophies? Do we want the same things in life for our children, for our families? Oh, really? Great. Let's continue. Let's have fun now, and then let's get married. So basically, there's a goal. It's a different goal. Okay? It's not about falling in love. It's about getting married. That's also something that happens. Maybe we'll talk about that as we get on to love and intimacy, about what's the cause and effect. How does the cycle of love work? Okay, so meanwhile, let's get on with some more of the questions. So we are going to jump right into it now. Okay? We have the dating, we get married, and then we have a mitzvah that is called mikvah. I'm sure many of you have heard of mikvah. If you haven't, I'm sure you've seen it on the show. The mikvah is that ritual, spiritual swimming pool that a woman goes into when she is what we call impure. It's a spiritual impurity. It has nothing to do with physical cleanliness or dirtiness, but there are some times, and we're going to get to Stacy right now, Stacy Goldman, who's going to explain to us more in depth about this mitzvah of going to the mikvah. What does it mean? When does a woman go? Why does she go? What's the mitzvah all about? So, Stacy, the floor is yours.
Hi, my name is Stacy Goldman, and I'm originally from Minnesota. And I live in Philadelphia, a few blocks away from Gevura, and where Sarah Esther used to live, and for whom I used to write for The Jewish Woman. So I have five boys, only boys, ranging in age from 13 to 23. They're all home right now, which is the silver lining in all this. My 23-year-old made Aliyah. He's a veteran of the Israeli Army. Very proud of him. And I teach at Kohelet Yeshiva High School, which if you Google, you can see that they are using their fab lab to make face shields for medical professionals in local hospitals. It's an amazing school. And I am also a yoetzet halacha. A yoetzet halacha is something that's been around for over 20 years in Israel and just over 10 years in America. There are 142 yoetzot worldwide, 27 of them in North America.
Do you want to define it?
Yes, I'm going to
tell you. Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't know if you were going there. Okay.
It literally means legal advisor. And it's a program started by Nishmat, which is a women's seminary in Israel. And it's an intensive over 2-year program that trains women who are already fluent in studying Talmud and Jewish law. So that's specifically addressing in the movie the line about women not being allowed to learn Talmud, which is clearly not across the board. It's the mainstay of what we study to become certified. And we learn more intensely than men training for rabbis and more in depth. And we have written tests all along the way, and it ends with an oral test with 4 different rabbis, 1 in America, 3 in Israel. We have to fly to Israel. And they ask us any question from the entire over 2 years of intense study. after which we get certified as yotzot, and we are then qualified with rabbinic backing to answer questions that are related to the mikveh and women's health. In addition to the Torah-based study, we also have a women's health, sexual, psychiatric, fertility, all different areas that we might encounter in women's health. One of our teachers is on the call right now. And so we have a really full background in both women's health and the Jewish law relating to this area. I am the official Yoatzet Halacha of the Young Israel Eish in Las Vegas. So I go there a few times a year and take questions from the women in that community. You can feel free to look me up if you like. And it's a really exciting field for women because it's new and it's a whole world opening up to women in Jewish learning and leadership. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about mikveh. So it's actually, for all of you listening and getting ready for Shabbos, even though it's only Sunday, this is in this week's parsha. If you were going to shul, which none of us are, but actually because I have five boys, so in my house, we read the Torah portion every week. We all pray together around the dining room table and we take turns reading, chanting from the Torah portion. And it really makes it special. So this week's Torah portion is all about the basis for these laws of going to the mikveh. So for women, when she gets her period, the period is considered to flow for a minimum of 5 days. And once the flow is over, she counts 7 clean days. There's a lot of background with all this that I'm not going to go into. And then once those 7 days are over, that she has not had any blood, she then immerses in the mikveh. So Yaf spoke a little bit about tuma and tahara, these words that I don't like to translate, that we usually translate as pure and impure, but they have a connotation of dirty and clean, which they are absolutely not. And in fact, they are just ritual states that during the times when the Holy Temple existed, every person, not just married women, every man and every woman would go in and out of these different ritual states between tuma, impurity, and tahara, purity. And in order to become tahor, she or he would go to the mikveh. And this is in the category of chok, which is a category of Jewish law that we don't have any reasonable explanation for, as opposed to something like don't murder or don't steal, which are called mishpatim, which makes sense that any society in order to exist would of course have to have those laws. This is a category of chuk. The laws that we read about this past week, had you been in shul and reading the Torah portion about kashrut, is another category that we just don't know why. So this is that category. And so when I teach my high school students about these laws, I tell them, my girls, that had you been living in the time of the temple, this would have been an important part of your life. If you were part of your family's farm and you were harvesting your fruits and vegetables and you had to separate a tenth of your harvest for the priests, the Kohanim, you would have to do that in a state of tahara, of purity. And so you would have to go to the mikveh even if you weren't married. So today, what's amazing about these laws and these categories is that this is the last vestige between a husband and wife, and it's only between a husband and wife, it's not between a woman and any other man, that we have connecting us back to those holy days of the temple that we hope will come again soon. This is the one area where we still maintain these categories. In terms of whether it's a good or bad thing, I just want to comment that the greatest kindness that a Jew can do for another Jew is for that Jew after he or she dies in cleaning the body. That's considered the greatest kindness. And yet, in doing that act, that greatest kindness, that Jew who's cleaning the dead body becomes tame, the greatest state of impurity, in fact. So just by definition of this, it's impossible to think of tuma, of this impurity, as something bad, because it's something that you get when you're doing the greatest kindness that a Jew can do for another Jew. And that is the state that a woman becomes in when she gets her period and that she leaves when she properly immerses in the mikveh.
That's okay. A very good explanation. If anybody wants to learn more about it, because obviously we touched the very, very tip of the iceberg here, there's so much depth in this entire topic. Let us know, because as I mentioned, we definitely would consider having a part two where we would go more in depth, maybe into some of these beautiful women's mitzvot. Okay? So okay. Let us know your questions. But Stacey, let me ask you, because this is a question that came in from some of the women here. In the show, when Esti, the metaphoric character, was going into the mikvah, she was standing there naked, and the mikvah attendant was inspecting her body, her naked body. Does okay. this happen in real life?
This is, I brought one of my big tomes of books that I use for my program to study that I refer back to when things come back. I want to show you. So that is an excellent question. So again, none of us here can speak for the world of Satmar and what goes on in their mikvahs and what goes on there. I actually just started working for my local mikvah in Lower Merion. It is such an honor and a privilege. And the reason why I just started is because usually a mikvah lady is an older woman. And because this is one of the last mitzvot that we can do outside of the house with the coronavirus, it's such a special privilege. It's ironic, maybe not ironic. All of the women's mitzvahs are things that we can still do today through coronavirus, making challah, lighting Shabbos candles, and going to the mikvah. And why did I start working there? Because most of the mikvah ladies were older women, and our community wanted to keep those women safe, and so they recruited some younger women. And one of the greatest sensitivities that we have is empowering the women who come to the mikvah and making them feel safe and unexposed. And we do it in such a way that we only see the top of her head. And the actual Jewish law, it's from Yoridea Kuf Tzarichetz Seif Mem. So it's a section 195 of the Code of Jewish Law relating to these laws, subsection 40. Okay? So it says that the only purpose for the woman who is watching the other woman dunk is to make sure that all of her hair goes into the water. And it's interesting because women dunk at night, and today we have artificial light. So in those days, it actually talks about if it's during night, which when they wouldn't have been able to see in the medieval period, then it says she can wear a very, very loose net around her hair to make sure that it all stays around her and goes into the water with her. But that's really the only purpose of the woman watching. So when we as attendants at the mikvah are attending a woman who's coming to the mikvah, we try our hardest to only be able to see the top of the woman's head. I try very hard not to see any other part of the woman's body. Sometimes if she wants, and not during the coronavirus, we're not touching the woman at all. If she wants, she'll ask the attendant to make sure she doesn't have any stray hairs on her back. But during the virus, we're not touching them at all. There's no interaction, and it's just about seeing the top of her, all of her hair go into the water. So in my world, and I think most of the women on the panel's world, it's nothing like the scene that was depicted in the movie.
No, I actually worked as a mikvah attendant for quite a few years where I lived. And I know I'm young for that, but I did it. As you know, sometimes you stand up to fill a position that's needed. And I've never seen anybody's bodies. That wasn't what I was looking for. Right. You know, they were naked in front of me, but you know, we put up a robe in front of us. I was there to make sure that her hair, that she dunked in properly. That was it.
And I just want to address one more area of Jewish law. One of the other sections in this code of Jewish law relating to women and all of these laws, and it's called ne'amanus, which means trustworthiness. And it's an entire section devoted to the fact that women need to be trusted on their own bodies in this issue. When they go into a state of tuma, of impurity, and when they come out of that state into tahara, into purity, her husband, unless there's some very exceptional reason not to, her husband is actually obligated by Jewish law to believe his wife when she declares whichever state she's in. So it's actually a very empowering women's mitzvah. In fact, some of the rabbis believe that this area of trustworthiness is for a woman in terms of mikvah is the basis for, if you keep a kosher home, why you don't need a rabbi coming into your kitchen and certifying it kosher, that we trust you that your house is kosher if you say that it's kosher. So the basis for that is women. Okay, yeah?
Beautiful. Laura, were you talking?
Yeah.
You see me?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to add something very quickly about the mikvah and coronavirus, because I think a few people might be wondering why we're using the mikvahs. So the first thing, and we'll get into this one when Diana hopefully very, very soon speaks about intimacy, which is that a man and woman do not touch after a woman's period starts or any blood from her uterus flows. And so obviously being able to immerse in the mikvah and touch and be intimate and, you know, have sexual relations and all forms of touching with her husband, it's very important that we're able to go to the mikvah. But I want you all to really know and understand that the people who have been making the decisions about mikvah use during coronavirus have been consulting the top medical physicians, and all of the, well, hopefully the mikvahs that I'm associated with, the mikvahs that I'm involved with, are taking directives directly from the CDC. For example, in Philadelphia, where we have Rebbetzin Adina Schmidman at the sort of rabbinic helm of the mikvah, all decisions are being made in conjunction with Dr. Michael Bronfman, who's the head of director of medicine at Pennsylvania Hospital, one of the top hospitals in the world, and also an infectious disease specialist.
Yeah.
So it's just, and social distancing, the mikvahs have taken great lanes to allow women to engage in this really beautiful mitzvah. And it's a great point that you brought up, Stacey, about being able to continue this mitzvah even when the whole rest of the world is shut down. But we're only doing so all the while that the CDC and the top physicians deem it safe. If at any point they would tell
you, did
it freeze?
I think she froze. Our mitzvahs are treated with bromide and chlorine at somewhat higher levels than normal, and there is no evidence of the COVID-19 virus going through those chemicals.
Exactly. And I think it's important to mention, by the way, there are many, many women who were supposed to go to the mikvah. It was their time. And again, if you don't know what we refer to when we say supposed to, there is a system of how many days to wait, and then you go. And by the way, the concept of going to mikvah, when a woman has her menstrual cycle monthly, she and her husband disconnect sexually and physically, and the mikvah is what creates a union again between the two of them. So there are women, there are selfless, holy women who have not gone to the mikvah this month or even last month because they had been exposed to COVID-19. And even though they themselves were not sick, they did not go to the mikvah because they did not want to, for somebody else, you know, to spread the virus at all. And they gave up on their own intimate relationship with their husbands for the greater good of the rest of the community. So it's important to have that in mind, that it's really, you know, there's this all around connection, and it's affecting everyone. And these are women's choices that they're doing because they want to do the right thing. Okay. So now let's move on. And again, any further questions can be sent in to us. So now we understand a little bit about the mikvah and a little bit about how, what the point of it is, what we do with it, what that mitzvah is for a woman. And now we're going to move on a little bit. As I mentioned, after the mikvah, there's a special mitzvah, actually mikvah night, to resume intimate relationships between husband and wife. So we're going to get to that very soon, okay? Meanwhile, the next exciting topic, and that is, and this
why
again.
Why everyone tuned into the show anyhow.
What?
Which is
why anyone tuned into the show. Exactly. But first, because I think this is another pressing issue, we are going to talk about hair covering. What do you all think I have going on under hair? That's the question, right? I actually have really long hair, and I think some of these women who have their hair covered also have long, beautiful hair underneath their wigs. So the question really is, and this is a question that came in, do all women shave their heads after they get married? And why do some women wear wigs, some wear scarves? I see some women here in hats, right? We have all different types of hair coverings. why? Like, why are there so many different ways to cover your hair? And what does it look like under these things? So let's turn to Sarah Esther. Where is she? There you are. Sarah Esther, okay. Would you like to start this conversation?
Sure. Well, it's fascinating what Stacy quoted about, you know, even the net over the hair, which is, if anything, a source proof that clearly women are not all shaving their heads if the role of the mikveh attendant is to ensure that the hair all be immersed when the woman immerses in the mikveh. But, you know, an overarching thing that's just really important, because that was one of the biggest questions that consistently came in: do all women shave their heads? And then there's also the different ways, obviously, to cover hair. And it's just important to quickly contextualize and understand, you know, hair is a huge topic, not just in Judaism, but across all cultures and societies. Anthropologists and historians and theologians have loved to interpret the power of hair, the meaning of hair, the symbolism, and there's extensive just research that's been done on this. In Judaism, it's a key topic as well, both hair of men and hair of women. We have, you know, a Jewish boy does not have his hair cut until he turns 3. There's the Nazir, the Nazirite, who doesn't cut his hair. So we have a lot to do with hair. One of the overarching things, though, is that hair is always connected to power of knowledge. The hairs, obviously, which stem from the head. There's so much, by the way, I gave anybody interested. I did an entire, like, hour-long in-depth talk on hair. There's so much that it's a bit of a disservice to do it, you know, in just a minute or two. But, and actually the hair that we all see is dead anyway. We've got a $90 billion hair industry. And, you know, as much as we're supposed to, like, love and connect to our hair, we're also completely always encouraged, if it's straight, perm it, and if it's, you know, curly, straighten it, and have extensions and dye it and do all these different things to it. But within Judaism, the idea is that because the hair comes from the head and the actual living part of hair is something that we can never see, it's invisible to the eye with everyone, that it is really stemming from knowledge, and knowledge is always related to sexual intimacy. The key source that says the Adam Yadad Chavishto, and Adam knew, right? To know in the biblical sense, with this idea of knowledge. And hair is the one area within the, you know, kind of guidelines of modesty that shifts upon marriage. You know, all of the other parts of our body that we keep covered is all the time. It doesn't, you know, have a different status when one marries, yet hair does. So clearly the shift that takes place in hair is between unmarried and married, which results in between prior to sexual relations and post-sexual relations. And according to Jewish mysticism, hair is this gateway. It's the gateway for knowledge, for our innermost thoughts and our deepest essence. We know that all of the DNA of a person can be found in one single strand of hair. And so the covering of the hair is something that post-marriage allows our most intense sensuality and sexuality to be private and to be contained within the confines of our holiest relationship, which is our marriage. And we, you know, the concept of shaving heads, that may and is the case in certain groups of Hasidim. Generally speaking, it's not the case. Within Chabad, it's actually highly discouraged to shave one's head unless that's something that both husband and wife find very attractive and like. But that hair is supposed to be something that, you know, adds and enhances beauty. Women keep their hair all various lengths and colors and styles, however they want to do it. For some, it's practical. A lot may have beautiful flowing hair. I am a very practical person, whatever's going to be just easiest to maintain and quickest to dry, you know, but that's personal choice. And the idea specifically even with the different forms of covering, and this is something I'm speaking to now within the Hasidic philosophy of Chabad, is that because hair is so special and holy and intense, it's actually the only people who need to know that one's hair is covered is the husband, the wife, and God. It's nobody else's business. And so there's that idea that it's really like this secret, and yet the wig is, I have a secret, and it's a secret, it's a secret, right? You don't know that if you're looking at me, that I'm covering my hair, as opposed to maybe a different form, which it becomes, you know, clear. Oh, you know, the hair is being covered this way. It's, you know, like, ooh, top secret. What's there? What's under there? So it's, you know, it's different ways and approaches. Each way has its own meaning and significance. But specifically, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very strong that a wig should be as beautiful and as natural and as attractive versus attracting, but attractive as possible. And that it shouldn't raise that question because nobody else needs to look at a woman and know her hair is covered. That's something that is within the intimacy of her marriage and between her and her husband. Likewise, by the way, with mikvah, also something very quiet and reserved for the couple, not something that's just, you know, spoken about and shared with other people. It's, you know, private between husband and wife.
Exactly. It's supposed to be very private. Yeah, wow, that's really beautiful, and it creates more of a connection when there's something that you just you share only with your husband, as opposed mm-hmm. to sharing with everybody else. It actually creates a much closer level of intimacy. So that's really beautiful. I see somebody asked over here if you're allowed to dye your hair underneath. Absolutely, any color you. I mean, when I was younger, I used to be fuchsia under hair. I went crazy. Like, no one sees it anyway. Who cares? Only my husband. And, you know, we had fun with it. Now I don't, because whatever, who ain't nobody got time for that. But you can. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So that was beautiful, Sarah Esther. Thank you. Is there anything?
Just one quick thing. Just very quickly about, because this comes up a lot. If the wig is more beautiful, the wig is completely dead hair. Our hair still has the part that's alive. It's actually one of the few, it's like a dichotomy on our body. We can cut it. And it doesn't hurt, and yet if you pull it, it hurts when it's connected to the source. The wig is completely, totally dead. I can assure you, as beautiful as it is, nobody wants to run their fingers through your dead hair wig. So the intensity to it is cut off literally when it is removed from the head and the source of our intellect and our power.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Absolutely. Okay, so anybody want to add anything else into this before we move on? Any of the panelists? Okay, so thank you so much. That was really beautifully expressed. And now we are moving on to dun-dun-dun, intimacy. Well, okay, we're going to call it intimacy. I'm about to introduce you to Diana over here. Maybe you can unmute yourself, or can I unmute you? Let's see. Gavura, I think you need to unmute her, okay? If you don't mind. So we're going to talk about intimacy, and I'm using the word intimacy. Intimacy is not only sexual. Intimacy is, it's a little bit deceiving to use that word in itself, because intimacy is also, it's all encompassing. There's emotional intimacy, and it's supposed to be all connected. We don't separate, in Judaism, we don't separate intimacy, emotional intimacy, intellectual intimacy, spiritual intimacy, and sexual intimacy. It's all connected. It's all one. So we are talking about intimacy, but we're also talking about sexuality within Judaism. And there are some questions that were sent in. So I'm going to go through all the questions now together. And then Diana, you're going to start off with, we'll kind of create a discussion based on all these questions, okay? All right, so question number one. Do brides really go through classes like that prior to getting married? Is this the first time that they are learning about sex? Next question. Do Orthodox women who never had any prior knowledge or sexual experience suffer more than the average woman with sexual issues after marriage? Do couples have sex? Oh, you know what? Let's get to those first, because then I think we're getting to another level. Should we get to those questions first? Diana?
Sure, whatever you want. You're the moderator.
Okay, well, just because, I mean.
So let's start there, okay.
Let's talk about education first, and then we'll get to the details afterwards, okay? So that's education.
Okay, so just by way of introduction, I'm going to answer one of those questions. So my name is Diana Melnick. I live in Toronto, Canada, and I run a clinic called Toronto Intimacy Counseling. We are a multidisciplinary clinic that treats both female and male sexual dysfunction. Personally, I'm a registered psychotherapist, so I take care of the therapeutic part of treatment. And in my team, I work with doctors, psychiatrists, pelvic floor physical therapists, you name it. Whoever we need on our team to treat the sexual dysfunction, that's who I work with. Our clinic does not only treat Orthodox Jews, we treat anybody. So we have a really beautiful, diverse group of folks that come and utilize our services. Jewish, non-Jewish, Muslim, Persian, whatever. The Seventh-day Adventists love me because I know about the Bible, and so do they. So we actually get along quite nicely. Aside from that, aside from running the clinic and being a mother, I also do something called Kala classes. What are Kala classes? So for close to 10 years, I've been a Kala teacher, which means that, answering that question, yes, it's true. Before an Orthodox girl or woman gets married, she meets with someone such as myself or Yafa. You're also a fantastic Kala teacher in Gevurah, and I think a lot of and Stacey, and all. I guess we're all Kala teachers.
Apparently.
There we go. So you meet with someone who preferably, hopefully, has training in the subject. Nowadays, most Kala teachers go through a rigorous training process to be able to teach about the laws of Judaism, of sexuality, of going to the mikvah, and so on. And also, hopefully, to prepare these Orthodox women for sexuality and to set them up for success in their sexual lives. Because as Gevurah explained earlier, there is typically not a whole heck of a lot of touching or physical intimate contact, right, before you get married. So that is a real thing. It's true. We do educate the women, depending on which sort of stream of orthodoxy they're coming from, that will sort of dictate, did they have any sex ed in school? So in the more modern Orthodox schools, they definitely do have sex ed, or they have, you know, when I went to modern Orthodox high school, it was called Mishpacha class. So in our Mishpacha class, you know, we were taught about going to the mikvah and separating from our husbands and so on and so forth. But in some of the more right-wing schools where they are more sheltered, they're not going to be, they would know theoretically about this concept of mikvah, but they would not know necessarily about male anatomy. They would know very little about sexuality, and more than that, healthy sexuality, right? So the Kala teacher's job is actually a really, really important job. And, you know, coming back to the movie, just for a minute, even though I'm not Satmar, and I do deal with dysfunction, again, secular, Jewish, non-Jewish, Hasidic, you name it, there's dysfunction everywhere, sexual dysfunction everywhere. But yes, you know, there are definitely Kala teachers who are ill-prepared themselves, and therefore, because they're uncomfortable with sexuality, because maybe they are not experiencing healthy sexuality within their marriage, maybe they've never felt pleasure, there's no way that they're going to be able to give over a healthy sexual message to the Kala they're teaching, right? So that's real, and it's unfortunate. But is it across the board? Is it true that every Orthodox girl has a horrible Kala teacher? Of course not. As I mentioned earlier, there's such great training that goes on now. I'm actually a Kala teacher trainer now. So I teach other Kala teachers, this is how you teach about sexuality. This is how you teach about orgasm. This is how you teach about intimacy, right? So it's actually great because we've been making really great strides. There was a question in there about do Orthodox Jews, because they have so little exposure to sexuality and intimacy before they get married, like, are they more dysfunctional, right? Was that kind of the question?
That was the question,
more,
yeah.
Do they have more problems? So
yeah.
One of the fascinating things that I see personally in my practice is that amongst the Orthodox couples who get married fairly young, because they're so young, because they already have a prior relationship with their kala teacher, or the men have a relationship with their rabbi who's taught them about these things, the fortunate thing that I see is that we're able to catch dysfunction much earlier. So, for example, in the movie, the girl was suffering from something called vaginismus. That is, you know, I treat dozens and dozens of women with vaginismus in my clinic. The great thing about vaginismus is when we catch it early, the treatment is much quicker. So if you can imagine this newlywed couple, so again, in the show, there was a lot of stuff that was not so great according to normal healthy psychology, which is like getting a mother-in-law involved or whatnot, which I'm not saying it doesn't happen. Maybe it does happen. Ideally, it wouldn't happen. So again, when you have a really young, innocent couple, things aren't working, they can call their college teacher and say, hey, I'm having really painful sex. I don't know what to do. So nowadays, again, with the training, the college teachers pretty much know about which therapists treat what. They know about pelvic floor physical therapy. In my city, the rabbis know about pelvic floor physical therapy. So even the head rabbis are now sending women right away for treatment and getting on board with saying to the husbands, you're going to have to take a break. You're going to have to cool it while we work on this issue, right? So we don't want to cause any more trauma. So in some ways, so again, everybody suffers. I have non-Jewish women with vaginismus. I have Orthodox women with vaginismus. What I am finding is when you have someone to turn to with that prior relationship, in some cases, we can troubleshoot the problem much earlier. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah, perfect. Exactly. Okay, fantastic. Now let's move on to the next question. All right, let me see a thumbs up from anyone who thinks that we have sex with a hole, with a sheet with a hole in it. Anybody? Anybody? Newsflash. Don't. Okay? So here's this question. Do couples have sex with their clothes on? Because this is what we saw in the series. Their clothing were on. They were dressed, you know, from there to there. And are women, do we have sex with clothes on? And is this where the whole, you know, hole in the sheet idea came from in the first place? So let's first address that.
Okay, so I mean, I actually would love for Stacey to, because she's more of the authority in terms of biblical text, because the biblical texts themselves do talk about the fact that when we are intimate, the focus is on pleasure. Yeah. Not only that, the focus is on pleasure, the focus is on giving to each other and enjoying our bodies, right? And so, Stacey, maybe you want to talk about how actually you're not supposed to have your clothing on.
Right. So logically, right? From a place of Jewish law. First of all, we would love to hear, you know, what does Jewish law say about that? And what, in fact, again, according to Jewish law, is the husband's responsibility?
Right.
So, during sex.
So, mainstream Jewish law is that there cannot be anything coming between you and your spouse during sexual relations, that it has to be, you both have to be completely naked. It's supposed to be ideally done in a way that is respectful and honors both people. And in terms of modern day halacha, that can be interpreted to mean a lot of different things in different Orthodox Jewish worlds. And a man, in terms of the actual pleasure, it's actually the man's obligation to provide pleasure for his wife. She got that right in the show. And there's an actually really interesting midrash based in this week's parsha. So the parsha is called Tazria, which is a really weird Hebrew word. It can be meant literally as when she emits seed and has a boy. And that's the whole verse. Not the whole verse. That's the beginning of the verse. And the rabbis interpret this to mean that if she emits seed first, whatever that means, she'll have a boy. But if he emits seed first, it'll be a girl. So it gives an added motivation in sort of the ancient patriarchal mindset, which doesn't really exist today, that the man would want his wife to be pleasured first before his own pleasure so he could have a boy. But it is a man's obligation in the marriage contract to sexually satisfy his wife, and that's a really important part of Jewish marriage.
Yeah, and when I teach a bride before the wedding, I say, you know, did you guys choose your ketubah? Right? The ketubah is that marital document that's being read. They're like, oh, yeah, it's so beautiful. We're so excited. I'm like, okay, great. Who's going to be reading it? And then they say, oh, the rabbi. I'm like, really? So do you want to know what it says? And then we laugh about it because, you know, you got this rabbi or this, you know, very important, dignified person who's reading, and Joshua is promising to provide sexual pleasure to Laura.
Exactly.
And this is being read out loud in front of, you know, your 500 guests, right? I mean, not during coronavirus, but typically, right? And again, like when we look at the Torah view on sexuality, it is about the woman's pleasure. Rashi, who is an ancient Jewish scholar, talks about pleasure as the glue that holds a marriage together. And without that pleasure, without that glue, your marriage could fall apart, right? So it's not just about a woman lying there and doing her wifely duties. There is no such concept in Judaism. That's a lie. It's made up, right? The main mitzvah is for a man to give his wife ona, ona being loosely translated as sexual pleasure. So that is the obligation. And when we talk about the clothing, again, clothing optional, right? So ideally you're flesh on flesh. Ideally you can experience the full pleasure of your bodies. But of course, if somebody likes to wear a certain outfit, go for it, right? The rabbis actually have come out and said, well, lingerie and other outfits are considered your skin. So whatever it is that's going to enhance the experience is very, very much encouraged.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And in fact, you know, foreplay is encouraged as well. We didn't see that in the show, which made it even harder, right? It would have been a lot easier for her had there been foreplay to help open her up, to help her feel, experience, you know, and it's very much encouraged in Torah Judaism. It is. So it's important to have that understanding as well.
Yeah, and so ideally when the rabbi is teaching the man before the wedding, right, in their chatan classes or chasen classes, this is what they're being taught. They're being taught, give pleasure to your wife, don't jump into things right away, she needs time to relax, right? So again, like in my job, one of the things I do is I meet with these big rabbis and I teach them about the sexual response cycle. And I'll say to them, you know, Rabbi, it typically takes a woman 45 minutes to an hour to reach an orgasm. You know, and like, and then the rabbis are like, they love it. They want the education because they want to be able to give over that information 100%. To their 100%. Students.
Right. Everybody wants what's best for our society. When I teach my brides, I teach them especially on the first night, but even after that, I tell them, you know, don't jump right into sex. Spend the whole night cuddling, touching, getting to know each other. Drink some wine. Not too much, by the way. You got to make sure you know who your partner is. Okay. But, you know, drink a little bit, get a little happy, you know, a little relaxed. It's very important. And I always try, before my bride gets married, I always try, if he's comfortable, to have a conversation with the groom also, so that I can just make sure they're on the same page in what's about to happen, you know, just to make sure, because it's also extremely...
I do want to, you know, normalize the fact that, you know, we're giving over the ideal version of sexuality. We're giving over the ideal way that this should play out in an Orthodox Jewish marriage. I wouldn't have a job if this is how it worked every single time, right? Like, I wouldn't have couples coming to me with such severe sexual dysfunction or crackles in their foundations of their marriage if every rabbi was perfect at giving this over and every student listened and every girl got the message, right, and knew her body and knew how to orgasm, right? So obviously we're giving you guys over the ideal scenario, but in real life, it doesn't always happen this way. And
right.
And there's, you know, and it's normal. It's normal that it's not perfect.
Right. There has to be a balance. On one hand, we're seeing one extreme over here. On the other hand, we're watching movies and shows that show the opposite extreme that isn't reality either.
It's some people's reality. Can we just say that?
It can be
truth
reality.
Is that it can movie be. Was some people's reality.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
100%. All of it can be reality, but there's no one reality. That's, you know, there's no one way, just like there's no one way to do anything. There's no one way to parent. There's no one way to diet. right? We just have to know what the ultimate goal is and what does Judaism really teach us regarding all this. So that's what we're explaining over here. Okay? Just a few more questions and then we're done, okay? We'll go through the rest quickly. Okay, so over here, there's another question here that says, it seemed really wrong that he continued to have sex with her when she clearly wasn't interested. Is that allowed? I didn't think a couple could be intimate if they had been fighting.
Correct. So the Talmud or, you know, the ancient Jewish texts go through 9 different variations of people's moods and connection. And when they are disconnected in one of these ways, it is forbidden to have relations. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but some of them are if you're drunk. Right. So you mentioned a glass of wine or two is fine, but like if you're drunk and you don't know what's happening, you're not allowed. Right. If you have had a huge fight or argument and you're feeling really emotionally disconnected, it's not allowed, right? If you are thinking about another person that's not your partner, not allowed, right? If you've decided to divorce and whatever, there's a lot of, you know, anything that disconnects the couple emotionally, anything that disconnects the couple, right, in any way, there is directive or surrounding that it is not allowed, right? Rape is not allowed, right? So if somebody is raping their partner, that is not allowed according to the Torah, right? Period.
Absolutely. I just want to say how incredible it is that the Torah recognized marital rape, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
How progressive that is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, right.
The Torah is completely relevant in every generation. So it recognized that even before our society recognized marital rape, the Torah did. So it's pretty amazing.
Right. These different scenarios where the couple is forbidden from having sexual relations if one partner is asleep or if they're fighting, is basically telling us that sexual intimacy has to be an absolute choice and desire mm-hmm. of both partners, and it has to stem from love. It cannot come out of anger. It can't be, you know, coming from any other motivation. So, you know, beautifully with everything she was explaining, when things are not working, we have a real motivation within Jewish philosophy and law to seek help, to understand why is this not feeling right? Why is this not loving? Why is this not comfortable? Because we know that ideally it should be. So the one thing I would say is what the show definitely depicted is that was absolutely across the board wrong. It wasn't, you know, that there are different.
Can I just, Esther, like, you're right that they depicted it as wrong, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Because unfortunately, it happens.
Right. No, she's not saying, but I don't think, right, I don't think Sarah Esther's saying that it was wrong in the story. It did happen. She's saying it's wrong that it happens.
Good.
Right. No, 100% it happens. And one thing is important for us that I really want to reiterate and reemphasize quickly is that whatever happened in her life, in the author's life, and whatever happened with people who have similar stories, it is absolutely very real. And anything that we're talking about over here is in no way about minimizing their pain or invalidating their stories, because all of that happened. But we're here to explain what the Torah perspective is and why, even though those things might be happening, that doesn't mean that the Torah condones it, because it doesn't. And it's wrong according to Torah. Okay? So all of these things you just mentioned, Dan and Sarah Esther, this is how we understand that intimacy, as we started off this topic saying, is all-encompassing. It's not just about being together physically. It's about being together emotionally. Even when you're together physically, there has to be an emotional connection, an intellectual connection, all together as one, okay, which is why we have those laws about when to have some separation. Now, is the purpose, another question, is the only purpose of sex within Judaism to have kids? Like, is this the main purpose? And if so, what happens when a woman reaches menopause and is no longer able to get pregnant? And just to add to that question, what about if she's on birth control? What about if she's infertile or if he's infertile, right? And I also saw a question pop up on the screen before from the chat over here where somebody asked, she said she never knew, I think until watching this show, she said she never knew that the reason religious Jews have so many kids is to make up for all the people who were killed in the Holocaust. So these are, you know, interesting questions and actually really good questions. And we know that the mitzvah, there is a mitzvah of ona, which is the actual mitzvah of sexual relations. That mitzvah is a mitzvah of connection between husband and wife. It is the main objective of sex between husband and wife is to create love and a deeper connection. There's a separate mitzvah in the Torah of peru or revu, which is having children. The main objective is not to have children. It's actually to create love and connection. And that's why, even if you can't have children, we still have a mitzvah of being together, of husband and wife still connecting in the most intimate and the most sexual ways, because that's really what it's all about.
And if I may jump in just to sort of mention something from the show that was also a question that a few people wrote into the chat, which is, and Diana briefly touched on it, about male education. So when I was discussing dating and marriage, I was saying that later we would get to, so what is the purpose and why this dating system is the best methodology to achieving the purpose. So as Yaffa just explained, the purpose of marriage is not to have children. That's a separate mitzvah. The purpose of sex is not strictly to have children. So yes, people can have sex if one of them is infertile. You can have sex when you're pregnant. You can have sex when you're on birth control. Contrary to popular belief, birth control is part of Orthodox Judaism. Mm-hmm. I don't have time into the specifics of which types and why, but you can have intimacy even after menopause. So that was another question that came up. But I also want to say, how a couple goes from never touching before to being able to consummate the marriage, which was one of the challenges in the show, to learning how to bring each other pleasure. Because people often, when I talk about the dating aspect, people will often say, well, if you've never touched before, how do you know that you're compatible? And getting back to a point that I believe Sarah Esther made about knowledge being a big part of it, which is why on those levels that Stacey, those times that it's prohibited to have relations, as Stacey mentioned, a lot of them have to do with not being conscious. Like a person cannot have sex if they're so drunk because A, it can't be free will, it can't be choice, it can't be consensual, but B, because it's a exercise of taking two people, two halves of the soul, and joining them together in the highest form possible. And ideally, it's a fusing of emotion, of sexuality, of physicality. And the very bonds that brings people together is this mitzvah of ona, this mitzvah of pleasure, which can be interpreted as orgasm, but also just in a general sense, bringing positive sexual feelings to the other person. And In the religious world, we are constantly trying to address our challenges, address our problems, and try to help create human behavior that is in line with the beautiful ideals that the Torah prescribes. So for me, one of this, many scenes in the show were sad because A, they depicted how it was not supposed to be, even though sadly it was her experience and it could be other people's experiences. But for me, one of the saddest scenes of the show was when her husband, Yanki, was with the German prostitute, and he asked her how he could bring his wife pleasure. And we saw from this that one of the major missing elements was education on his part. So someone asked in the chat how a couple could go from never touching to being fully intimate and what that process will be. And I think that it's very important to note that the foundation of intimacy, of sexual connection is intimacy, is exclusivity, but it's really of connection. And that's why, as Sarah Esther first mentioned, the verb used between Adam and Eve was that he knew her. What does that mean? That he got to know all of her, which parts felt good, which areas to touch, which areas to kiss. And this is a...
But can I jump in for 1 minute, Kura, if that's okay? I agree with you, that was super sad because it's like, come on, man, right? Like, he had no clue. But the truth is, when in my work with couples, I have so many couples that come in where I'm not going to blame men or women, right? Like, they're clueless. And it's their own fault or whatever because they never communicated. Yeah. And that's part of the problem. And even when we think about sexuality and men knowing how to pleasure women or women knowing how to pleasure men, it's so subjective to your current partner. So even if you were with another partner, like, so what, right? Your wife or your current partner is going to have a very different sense of pleasure and a very different sense of what turns them on and makes them feel aroused. So yes, it's important to have sex ed and have sexual education in terms of certain body parts that may be very important, and education in terms of pain does not equal pleasure for many people, so let's not go there, right? But more than that, it's just so important to teach people to communicate. Openly.
But that's part of the education aspect. Yeah. That's part of the ignorance that we see there.
And to ask questions and to, show each other and guide each other and talk.
That's what helps create the entire ambiance of intimacy, is being able to sit and talk about it, discuss it. And that in itself, by the way, is foreplay. Just talking about it.
100%.
And to just kind of bring this full circle, when we were talking about mikvah and how there's a period of the month where the couple is not sexually intimate, they're not physical, that is our built-in time that is basically forcing us to communicate.
Yes.
And that is our opportunity to create, verbal intimacy and be able to share our innermost thoughts and feelings in a way where we cannot rely on a hug or a kiss to share love or to express love. So it's actually when it's done correctly, a beautiful built-in system that really provides that time and space for all of that necessary communication so that when we come back together physically, the intimacy is now heightened. It's that much more aroused, not just on a physical level, but on an emotional level and, spiritual level and everything that's wrapped up within that.
Absolutely, because it gives us the opportunity to connect in all the other dimensions, because when you can be together physically, very often, how do you deal with fights? How do you deal with frustrations? You jump into bed together. There's makeup sex. There's whatever. But you never discuss it. You never connect. You're never able to really build on the relationship because you're distracted by the external. So this is part of the reason why we have this system of separation and union every month. It really is pretty brilliant. So now we have one more question. All right. We'll finish up with this one question that we have here. Are women really only valued because of their baby-making abilities? Are we a bunch of baby-making machines? Okay? Are women who are unable to have children ostracized or looked down upon? Because this definitely was the image that was portrayed in the show. So anybody want to?
I think this is a really loaded question.
It's a loaded question, and for this time of night, yeah.
And to discuss it would take more than 30 seconds. Right. But I just want to give my 2 cents and then I'll open it up for everyone else. My 2 cents are that in the Bible, when we have the 4 mothers, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, they were barren other than Leah, right? Like, they had to pray and they had to endure. They had to endure that struggle of not having children for many, many years. And no one got divorced. No one was thrown out because they couldn't provide their husband with a baby. Now, having said that, again, that's the Torah ideal where, no, we are more than just a baby-making machine. Reality could be really different. So even though there could be childless couples and there could be women who, yeah, no one's kicking them out. They're not getting divorced. But society treats them in some cases as inferior. And it's terrible and it's sad. And I'm not going to gloss over it because it's horrible. Right. So I'm going to let other people respond with what they see, but my heart goes out to them and I don't even want to like sugarcoat it because it happens and it's terrible.
Can I respond to that?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
So there's a verse in the Torah when Rachel, who's one of our barren foremothers, says to her husband Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." And Jacob responds seemingly angrily and inappropriately, and he says, "Am I in place of God?" He isn't sympathetic at all. And there's a medieval commentary that says that the reason why he was angry is because he feels that Rachel didn't recognize the dual role of women. That woman in the first chapter of Genesis is called Isha, woman, but she also is named Chava, which means mother of all things.
Right.
And what Jacob was saying to Rachel is that you're not dead if you don't have children. You still have a purpose in life as an Isha. Some of those Nashim, Isha women, also get to be Chava, mother of all life. But it doesn't mean that she doesn't have a purpose as a woman in a meaningful way to contribute to the world.
Well, actually, so she's called Chava, Ein Kol Chai, mother of all, before she ever has children.
Right.
So there's also a beautiful explanation that the concept of motherhood, this ability to mother another, to give life, there is obviously the physical explanation, and by no means to minimize the incredible pain and difficulty and suffering of those who desperately want to have children and cannot. But from a Torah perspective, we were created to create. And if anything, actually, the commandment of Peru Revu to be fruitful and multiply is a commandment of men, not of women. But the idea is that whenever we're using our innate talents and unique abilities to create, to bring something into this world, we are fulfilling that commandment. And it says actually for all of the years that Abraham and Sarah had sexual relations and did not yet have children, that they created all of the souls of all of the converts for the generations to come, which is why a convert says that he or she is the son or daughter of Abraham and Sarah. So our intimacy, when Jewish sexual intimacy is holy and healthy and loving and connective, it creates. Does that always create into a physical child? No. Is that a terrible suffering and pain for one who's trying to have a child? Absolutely. But from a Torah perspective, it's not, we are not fulfilling that commandment. Right. If we can't or if we don't, and we actually still have that title of mother of all life because we right. mother in so many different ways and in so many different relationships. And, you know, just one example, the Lubavitcher Rebbe never had children. He and his wife never had their own physical children. And yet when the Rebbetzin was asked, you know, do you have children? She, you know, tens of thousands, the Hasidim, the students were the children. There is that idea that the people we connect with, the people we teach, the people we help guide, those are our spiritual children. Again, not to say that replaces the desire for our own physical children, but to understand it in Jewish philosophy, that merit is something we are all capable of and we all have an obligation to. In all areas of our life.
Absolutely. This is part of what the whole concept of purity and impurity is actually all about. Because the greatest source of purity in the world, as we know, is life. And therefore, the greatest source of impurity is a lack of life or a loss of life. So when a woman does bring a life into the world, we know that she's creating the ultimate purity. This is part of why she becomes spiritually impure. When she has a period, when she gives birth, why? Because there's the lack, the loss of potential for life. So it creates a spiritual void and a spiritual impurity. But this doesn't only refer to something physical, because anytime you bring life into the world, and this, by the way, the water in the mikvah is called mayim chayim. It's water that's alive. It has to be active, moving, living water. This is why a swimming pool is not a kosher mikvah, because it's dormant. It's not alive. The water in the mikvah is connected to a live water source. So the whole idea of bringing life into the world doesn't only mean birthing a child. Bringing life into the world means creating any sort of movement, any sort of growth. When you give a compliment to someone, when you guide someone, when you build someone up, you are creating life and you are giving the ultimate source of life into the world, and you're creating an entire energy of life in the world, and you're causing God to react to the world in a form of life. And of course, the opposite too. If we create a lack of growth, putting people down, being destructive instead of constructive, right? Then we're creating impurity in the world. So there's it's a much deeper concept of the pure and impurity that we're able to create as women in the world. And what we have to understand, and this is about Judaism in general and in many areas of life, but overall, there's one main goal, and everything else are just a means to reach that goal. And our goal in Judaism, it's one main simple goal. It's to create a relationship with God. That's why we're here, to create a close relationship with God. Now, how do we do it? There are many different paths to creating that goal, as long as it's within the guidelines of Torah. One path is to get married. One path is to have children. One path is to bring Mashiach. None of them are the end in itself. They're all a means toward an end. And sometimes it's a path for one person, sometimes it's a path for another person. So it's always important to have in mind there's a primary objective, and then there are so many secondary objectives as well. And we can't confuse a primary objective with a secondary objective. So that's just in a nutshell how we understand this. We are not baby-making machines. We don't only have children to make up for the Holocaust, by the way, because the mitzvah to have children happened way, way before the Holocaust. So I don't know where that comes from, where that mentality is from. It's not at all. We have children because we want to bring more purity into the world. We want to fill up the world with life and with movement and with love. That's why we bring more children into the world. And of course, we also know that we do want to reach the ultimate end of life, the ultimate redemption and liberation with the coming of Mashiach. So we want to make sure that all the souls are already going to be born into the world so that we can fill it up again with that life and beauty and love. That's why we have children. But again, there's the primary, there's the secondary, and we can't confuse them. Okay? So, I guess, in a nutshell, this is what we wanted to offer. What Judaism teaches regarding marriage, relationships, intimacy, community, connection, who we are, hair covering, whatever it is. So I hope that we were able to clarify all this for you. This was really an honor. It was a privilege to be a part of this. This is what we all did tonight. How many people? There were 300 on here, but plenty watching on Facebook as well, right?
Yeah. I wanted to just sort of end by saying, yes. Just really quickly back to the Holocaust comments. I didn't have a chance to explain this, but ultimately what actually led me in the direction of Judaism was taking Deborah Lipstadt's Holocaust class. Her trial was while I was a student at Emory University. And for me, I would say that this idea that the Holocaust has had a very strong imprint on the Jewish people's collective consciousness is very true. Satmar Hasidim in particular is a conglomerate of many different Hasidic communities that were completely destroyed before the war. And many, many, many of the early Holocaust survivors in Williamsburg many of the Satmar Hasidim that started the Williamsburg community were Holocaust survivors. Many of them had lost children. All of them had lost parents, siblings. And I think for me personally, I jumped on the train of Jewish practice after I studied what had happened to my people because they were Jewish. And suddenly I felt ashamed that I didn't know what it meant to be Jewish, and they all died for being Jewish. So I think even though no one would say, I'm having kids to make up for those, which is kind of an sort of interesting way of looking at it. I think that one cannot emphasize enough how much the Holocaust has impacted Jews that came from Europe and their descendants. But I also just want to mention, I know Yaffa mentioned this very briefly, that we were talking about our experiences, which hopefully, God willing, are good experiences, and that there are problems across the board in the world. As Diana mentioned, religious Jews are about half of her practice, but the rest of it is from just regular Torontans that also have challenges. But I don't want to in any way create a whitewashed version of everything is amazing. And to that end, I would like to end by sharing with you some resources that are extremely important. It is so, so, so important that we recognize and understand sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse for what it is and how wrong it is. And I'm going to be putting, I'm not very good. I can't figure out how to share my screen, but I'm going to put in the chat now some resources that we compiled for anyone who might know anyone who is in an abusive relationship or if they themselves are in an abusive relationship. And it is so important that we as educators share with you that our goal of education is to help educate people in the ways of Torah. The Torah is beautiful. We believe from an Orthodox perspective, we believe that God gave us the Torah, and it is all of the ways and pathways towards a beautiful life, a meaningful life when it comes to sexual intimacy, a healthy life, a life of pleasure. But if, God forbid, a person should find themselves not experiencing that, it is so, so, so important that they reach out and get the help that they need. And in Esty's case or Devorah's case, you know, who the show was based on, they maybe went to one source for help and it was not the right source. So if you are not finding in the Judaism that you're practicing or if your life in general, peace and holiness and pleasure, please don't wait until it's too late. Please don't let the pain continue to build. And please know what is normal and what is not normal. And I think I speak on behalf of all five of us, Yaffa, Diana, Stacy, and Sarah Esther, who I thank tremendously. No one here got paid. This was all volunteer work. We are here for you, and there are so many resources in the community. I know on this call alone, there are incredible teachers, educators, trained, informal, who are there to be there for you. And our goal was to provide a very small, each of the top as we were going through as educators before the call, as we were talking about what we wanted to talk about, every single one of your questions is an important question and really deserves its own 1 hour long class. Yep. But we are limited, and we're going to say goodbye for now and hope that we're going to continue this conversation. If you saw anything else in the show that you have questions about, please reach out to us. And if you have any questions about your own intimate lives, or if I think someone wrote into the chat, a great resource in the world is My Gift of Mikvah. There's an incredible organization called Mikvah USA that Sarah Esther and I and many incredible educators have the honor to work for. And we are here. We would love to come to your communities either via Zoom or in person once we're able to. And really, and I think I speak on behalf of all the educators, we're all here. Yaffa, I brought Yaffa into all the cities that I've lived in. You know, I ask Stacy all the time. So please, all of you should know that we are here for you. Diana does speaking jobs and has a private practice. Diana, do you take students over Zoom?
Depends on the law. Depends where they live. But I have, thank God, a really beautiful network of sex therapists, marital therapists, individual therapists all over the world, literally. So I'm happy to connect anybody who's looking for help.
And you can reach us all on Facebook or
If
you Google our names, you'll probably be connected to the websites for the organizations that we work for. But we're here for you. And if we, you know, I think I speak on behalf of all of us. Right now, especially, we are very busy with our kids and with our jobs. But if we can't answer your questions immediately, we will connect you to people in your cities who can. And we're here for you. And let's hope that there are no more Estes who are suffering sexually in her relationship.
Absolutely.
And please, again, I put it in the chat, but in case you didn't have a chance to look at it, you can reach out to me perfectly. There, privately, there are amazing organizations that are there for you to help you.
I want to give a shout out to Gabora because this was her brainchild.
Yes.
She got so, huge, huge, applauding, really. She was getting these questions. This was, by the way, this was before Passover, okay, when there was just so much free time that she, reached out to me then. It was like, how, I want to create a forum to be able to discuss this. And Gabora, just personally, you are such an inspiration that you saw a need, you saw people with questions, you didn't decide you were too busy or that too much was going on, and you made this happen. And the fact that we filled with 300 people right away in Facebook Live and, hopefully a follow-up, it's in your,
I have been getting messages this entire time. My phone has been blinking, telling me there's no more space. How can I get in? This was incredible how much people needed this and wanted this, and you just stood up and did it. And that's incredible. So thank you for taking care of it.
We just represent five of a whole network of educators that are here for you. And I know that there are people within the Orthodox community who are on this call who maybe have never heard of this kind of education before. There's an amazing organization called CORE, led by my personal teacher and advisor, Aliza Bulow, that is trying to build networks in every city in America to try to address some of these questions, address some of the problems. There's another amazing organization for anyone who might be on the call that this applies to called
Project Makom.
Yeah.
By our dear friend, Allison Josephs. You in the city. You could read about her online. She's also amazing. And just the door is always open. And as Yaffa so beautifully said, the idea of everything is to connect to God. And that connection should be out of love. And that God is always open and always available. And so are God's messengers, the educators. So we're here for you. And please reach out with follow-up questions, and we look forward to hopefully round two.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for joining.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gabora, will this be available for 24 hours for people?
Yeah, I missed the first 5 minutes, but I'll send it around. It's going to be available for 24 hours.
Okay.
And There were a few questions that I didn't, that were coming up in the chat that I didn't feel comfortable. It's called CORE to whoever was asking. If you contact me, we can try to connect you to Aliza Bulow, who runs that incredible organization.
Yeah.
There were a few questions that I didn't feel comfortable speaking about, knowing that this was on Facebook and that it was in mixed company and that I didn't want to speak with it. Those were good questions. Those were valid questions. We weren't not answering them because we were afraid to talk about it or because they weren't good questions, but that at a certain, it's more something that I would talk about in a private setting about positions, about sex. I know that those are important questions that people have, and you're welcome to reach out to them about them, to us.
Yeah. We have no problem talking about any of those things. There's nothing taboo. It's open. It's all beautiful. It's all special. It's all holy. It's just that, there are certain things that there are boundaries in everything, and we try to maintain, the holier something is, the more private it is also. So we talk about it, but not in a public setting when people are watching on Facebook and we don't know who they are. We'd rather keep it to a more intimate setting. So feel free to reach out to any of us, and we're so happy to talk to you about it.
Okay.
By the way, it says Shira by my name. That's my daughter. My name is Yaffa. So if you want, you can find me, Yaffa Falti. Okay?
She's beautiful, just like Yaffa.
What?
It means beautiful, just like Yaffa.
Oh, thank you.
I think all of our Facebook names are basically our names, correct?
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you next time, everyone. Good night. Thank you.